every time that I struggled, I knew I had these people, my network, who were going to help me stay believing in myself. And so I know not everybody has that. I know that a lot of these things come from self-confidence issues, and that was not my particular one. I understand that now. But if you don't believe in yourself, then you have to surround yourself with people who do believe in you, even if it's just one person, because that can help you keep going when you just want to sit there and beat yourself up.
Welcome to the CEO Coaching International podcast. What we do on this show is we find the world's leading entrepreneurs and CEOs, and we spend about a half hour with them and really dig into their story. We want to understand the strategies and the tips and the tools that they use to make big happen in their business. And by the end of each episode, you'll have actionable ideas that you can implement on your path to big success. To learn more about CEO Coaching International and how we can help you dramatically grow your business, visit us at CEOCoachingInternational.com. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the CEO Coaching International podcast. I'm your host, Steve Sandusky, and my guest today is Carrie Siggins. Carrie is the CEO of Stone Age, a company that designs and manufactures high-pressure water blasting tools and automated equipment for the industrial cleaning industry. Or, as Carrie likes to say, they make squirt guns on steroids. Carrie is also a member of YPO, sits on several boards, and also hosts two popular podcasts. In today's show, Carrie shares a very personal story about her journey into the world of drug abuse and despair to becoming the CEO of a company all before the age of 30. She shares the struggle and the lessons she learned in bouncing back from the poor choices that she made in her 20s. And while Carrie's story is personal, it's also universal. We've all made bad choices at one time or another, but those choices don't have to define us. And Carrie is an inspiring example of how where you start doesn't determine where you finish. With that, please enjoy my conversation with Carrie Siggins. Carrie, great to have you back on the show.
Great to be back. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, well, this is going to be a very interesting conversation because we're going to delve into your story. And you really have a fascinating backstory here. It has a happy ending, but I don't think it necessarily started out that way. So I want you to take us back to high school and your mom. You had a bit of a falling out. So tell me what happened and what, as a result of this falling out with your mom, what did that lead to?
Sure. So I am a boundary pusher, as my mom described it, wild, maybe with a few cuss words. And I always just really did what I wanted to do. And it was pretty destructive in high school. I was bored. And so it was easy to go out and push boundaries outside of school. And I got in a big fight with her and I moved out. And I was, I think, 16 years old, 15 or 16 years old. And I got a call from her at my friend's house. And she said, "You need to get home right now." I just was at the principal's office. And our principal had called her in to review some excused absent notes. And there were probably, I don't know, 30 or 40 of them in there, none with her signature on them. And she only picked out about five or six because she knew I would get expelled if she said, "None of those are my signature." So it was enough to get detention, but not to get expelled. And so it sparked a really fascinating conversation. And she basically told me when I got home, "When you're 18, you're out of this house. I don't care what you do with your life. I don't care if you work at Walmart for a living. I don't care how many kids you have as a teenager. Like, you're out of this house." And I thought, "Oh my God, you don't think I'm going to college?" And she said, "What are you doing that makes me think you're going to college? You don't even go to high school." And that was a stunning conversation. And it really caused me to look at what I was doing at the age of 16 and take real account and accountability of my life. And at that point, I said, "That's it. If people don't think I'm going to college, I'm going to prove everybody wrong. I'm going to pick the hardest school to go to in the state." I knew I had to go to a state school because my mom is a single mom and couldn't afford to put me through college out of state. And I'm going to get a softball scholarship and I'm going to just show everybody that I have what it takes to get through college. So I picked Colorado School of Mines, which is an engineering school, a top engineering school by any account. And I started really working on my softball skills and I was able to get into mines and I got a full athletic scholarship by the end of my, well, probably the first part of my senior year in high school. So it was a pretty profound conversation with me. That's the clean version.
Okay. Well, this is a G-rated show. So we'll...
Yes, you definitely have some very pointed language in there. It was what I needed to hear, to be honest. It was what I really needed to hear. So,
okay. So you graduate from high school, you go to college at Colorado School of Mines. So what was the college experience like trying to be an engineer?
It was awful. I am not an engineer. So part of the problem about just deciding that you're going to do something for the sake of doing it doesn't give you a lot of opportunity to explore why you're doing it. And I was good at math and science. I always had people pushing me towards engineering school, but I didn't really know what an engineer did. And so once I got into about my sophomore year, I knew that I should not be designing anything. I'm good at math, but I have no interest in how mechanical things go together, how chemical compounds break down. It's just not how my brain works. But I was determined to make it through because as I was going into engineering school, my dad told me that he didn't think I was smart enough to graduate with an engineering degree. So that was just like another one of those things about, oh, I'm going to prove somebody wrong and I'm going to make it through this school. And that's where I really learned this whole idea about resiliency because I don't actually really even remember much of college. Not because I was partying too much then, but mostly because it was just a means to an end for me. And I am so grateful that I had the softball team because that helped me stick with it. But I just persevered through it. I put my head down. I also did a business econ degree so that I could have something else to do besides engineering and just kind of suffered through grinding it out to make sure that I graduated from mines and can move to the next stage. But it was tough.
Now, some people say, well, I'm going to go to law school and get a law degree because I think that's going to be great training. Even though I don't ever want to be a lawyer, I think that's a good skill to have. And it sounded like you didn't want to be an engineer, but that certainly is a good skill. So how do you think about as a business person deciding between I'm going to go do this, or I'm going to go learn this, or I'm going to take this job for a couple of years because even though I may not like it, I think this is something that's going to be valuable for me and I can use in the future versus I'm not going to do this because A, I'm really not interested, even if it's good for me. Do you think of it in those terms at all?
Absolutely. Back then, I didn't necessarily think of it in those terms, but going to mines opened up all kinds of doors for me and it taught me so much about myself. Even though it was not maybe a normal college experience that most, you know, 19, 20 year olds look at going to, it was the best thing that I could have done. It has opened incredible doors. Having an engineering degree means you can solve problems. Engineering schools purposefully make it very hard to graduate because they want to know that you have the fortitude to be able to handle the pressures of an engineering career. And so looking back, I wouldn't change any of it. But in that moment, you know, in your 20s, as you're trying to figure out what am I supposed to do with my life? And I don't want to be this. It left me feeling a bit lost. So knowing what I know now, yeah, it's really important to do hard things and to stick with hard things and to do stuff that you don't like so that you learn about yourself. But hindsight's 2020.
Right. Sure. It's a little hard in the moment when all that's happening.
Yes.
So you graduate and then what happens?
I had a great internship through my junior and senior year in high school. And I decided to stick with it. It was easy for me just to continue into that role. And I knew I didn't want to be an engineer, but I was doing engineering work. But it was really unfulfilling and I was lost. And I didn't realize that I was lost then, but I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. And I also, as I learned about myself, have this part of my personality finds worth in being recognized. And I think that's where my boundary pushing comes in. That's why I decided that I was going to prove everybody wrong, right? It's that I want to be seen a certain way. So about 6 months after I graduated, I was in downtown Denver and I met this charismatic, just amazing, front of the line at all parties kind of guy, and totally fell for him. But the issue was, is that he was a drug dealer and he was one of Denver's biggest drug dealers.
Okay. So now how do you just meet a drug dealer in downtown Denver? You hanging out in a certain place or?
Yeah, I was just out of the club. I was just out at a nightclub. And I mean, I had dabbled a little bit in drugs, but I was never a big drinker, or I drank, but never was out of control. And I certainly didn't do a lot of drugs, especially at Mines. And so I was just at a club, and it was actually through a mutual friend. So his best friend from college was one of my high school best friends. So it was a mutual connection, and we were all just out dancing at a club. And I was like, hey, and so because I was a boundary pusher, I was willing to experiment a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm guessing this does not lead to something positive.
No. In about 6 months, I found myself with a pretty severe drug problem and in debt. I actually had to bail him out of a pretty bad drug deal gone wrong on my credit card. And I knew that I was in a really bad spot. I mean, it went from like never really doing anything and just experimenting to all of a sudden, like I went to work high. And so I knew I needed to get out of Denver. And so I do what anybody with a drug problem does, move closer to the border. So I ran away to Austin, Texas. This man followed me there and it only got worse. So we get to Austin and it was less expensive drugs, more drugs. And my life just continued to spiral for quite some time.
So then how long did this go on? And then what happened to start turning things around for you?
So the breaking point when I finally broke up with this man was when it was another drug deal gone wrong and a person came into my apartment with a gun. And I said, okay, that's it. I have to get myself out of this situation. And so it took me about a month to be able to get out of that relationship and move out. And then, but I still had my addiction problem. And so without him being there, I was able to control it a little bit more. It was still very prevalent in my life, but it wasn't as, I would say, scary as it was when you were living with a drug dealer. So for about 3 more years, I held it together, going out on weekends and a few weeknights. And then I decided in 2006, I wanted to do a figure competition. And a figure competition is when you get very, very lean and in a small bikini and you go on stage and have people judge your body. This is a horrible thing to do to yourself, especially when you are in the midst of a drug problem with all kinds of, you know, self-hatred issues going on. And that is when the beginning of the final unraveling started to happen, when I was constantly thinking about what I was eating, how I was working out while still in this cycle, this roller coaster of substance abuse.
Okay. And was there a final bottoming out that then was, okay, this is it. I'm done. I'm cleaning up my life.
Yeah. So this is when I really, this is like the life punching me in the face kind of thing. And it was exactly what I needed, but I almost died. And that was the end. But it wasn't actually almost dying that was the final straw. So it was Labor Day weekend of 2006 and Austin was in full party mode. And I was on day 3 of no sleep. And I had to go home and my body was just shutting down. And I got home and I took a sleeping pill and I knew I was going to get sick. And I stood up and I just hit the floor. And for about, I'm guessing 4 or 5 hours, I'm not 100% clear on the time frame because I was like in and out. I willed myself to get through what I was experiencing, which was an overdose. And I was able to just take one breath at a time and get myself through it. And finally, when I got enough wherewithal to figure out like, okay, you know, you're on the floor of your apartment. You know, I am not going to die on the floor of my apartment. Get into bed. I crawled into my bedroom, got into bed, and I slept for 24 hours. And for 2 days after that, I had to call in sick for work. And my mantra and everything I do is about working hard. You know, I went to Mines and I got 2 degrees in 4 years. You know, I held 3 jobs while I was in college. You know, I work. It's part of how, especially back then, that I saw my self-worth. And when I couldn't go to work for those 3 days, that was it. I was like, I'm a professional. Obviously, I'm a professional, right?
That's right.
Laying in bed with, you know, vomit in my hair and pizza on my pillowcase. And so that was really it. It was this rock bottom of like, okay, I almost died. And I almost died alone. And I can't go to work. And if I can't go to work, this is bad. This is really, really, really bad. And that was it. That was when I decided to call my mom and tell her everything and tell her I needed to come home.
So this was 2006. So you come home to Colorado. And not too long after that, things started to turn around for you. So what was the turning point? Once you got back to Colorado, what was the big turning point that got you on a good track again?
So it's exactly 1,000 miles from my apartment in Austin to my mom's house in Colorado, in Durango. And that entire 1,000 miles, I was in and out of crying, questioning what I was going to do, you know, almost turned around a few times going like, what am I going to do? Durango is a tiny little town. How do I survive here? I'm in debt. I don't have a job. But I just knew in my heart that I was supposed to be here. My mom, I needed my mom. I needed my roots. I grew up on the western slope of Colorado. And so that's what kept me driving towards Colorado.
Had your mom and you reconciled by that time?
Yeah, Yeah. My mom is really good at forgiving me.
Okay.
My mom is like, seriously, she's my heart and soul. She's the most amazingly strong person I know. Yes, we were good. We reconciled in those moments and have a great relationship. And she actually knew about my drug use throughout those years, just not how bad it was. So when I called her to tell her I needed to come home, it wasn't a surprise to her. Obviously, that's never a call that you want to get of like, oh, you know, I almost died, mom. But no, we were good. And she was like, come here. So I knew that's where I was supposed to be. And one of the things that I did before I left is I knew the power of networking. I'd been working in sales for a couple of years before I left Austin. And I had built a book of business from nothing to winning awards. And I did it all through LinkedIn networking. So I started to build connections before I left Austin, and I had appointments set up in Durango. I was just, I had no choice. I had to get a job. I had no money. And I actually applied for a general manager position for this little manufacturing company, Stone Age. And I thought, even though I'm grossly underqualified, I'm still going to apply for it. I've done all of these jobs as in operations management. And if I don't get the job, maybe I can just get my foot in the door for another open position. And the two founders and the management team saw something in me that they thought would be better for the company. So drive and passion and energy, intensity, intelligence. And the other two candidates were these, you know, experienced, but, you know, they're going to come in and force our company to change kind of people. That's what they thought. So they decided to take a risk and hire me. And 100%, I know that it saved my life going to work at Stone Age.
So that was 2007 when you get hired at Stone Age. And then you eventually become CEO. Who would have guessed? So tell me about the track from being hired. How long was it before you became CEO? And do you feel you were prepared at that point to be the CEO?
Well, I thought so, but no, probably not. No. Okay. So yeah, they hired me and I had no idea how to run a company. Like I was in account management. I had done operations coordination, a little operations management, but there was no reason that I should be running a company. So I just started asking questions and the employee base at Stone Age is so amazing. And they knew all the things that were going on that needed to be fixed. And they just needed somebody to come in and help fix it. The two founders, you know, they were both ready to move into different areas of their life. They've been running this company for 25 years. It was time for fresh blood. And so I just basically implemented things that people told me were problems. And that is how I solidified, you know, my success. Is I didn't come in and try to take things over. I just said, I have to learn everything from you. I'm young. I know nothing about this industry. Let's do this together. And it proved to be really, really successful. And within a little less than 3 years, I was named CEO of the company in 2009.
And I think there's a parallel there for entrepreneurs who start the company. Maybe they're in their 20s and they start the company. They've never been a CEO. Then the company starts growing rapidly. It's like, what do I do? How do I manage people? How do I hire an executive team? How do I run an annual planning session? It's like, and I think you said, I asked a lot of questions. Was there anything else that you learned along the way, like how to become a CEO while you are a CEO?
So I don't think that there's any way to learn how to be a CEO except for just be a CEO. Although you can certainly surround yourself with people who have been there and done that. And that's one of the things that I did. In 2010, I completely revamped my board of directors, and it proved to be one of the best decisions that I made. Now, that whole comment that you made about, you know, did you really know what you're doing? And maybe, you know, no, like, and they reminded me of that. Like, you don't forget, you're really young, you know, most people are not CEOs in your situation. And I probably got maybe a little too, I don't know, overconfident in building this success at times, but they helped hold me accountable, and I decided to use them as a competitive advantage. And that really helped because I had former CEOs on my board, and instead of being afraid of their advice and their feedback, I really embraced it. And I give credit, especially to three of them. I would not be the CEO I am today without their help and their advice and their belief in me and their support of me. So, you know, I think it's asking questions and relying on a really great team, letting my team do the job, a little bit of luck, and surrounding myself with really great mentors.
And the track I want to go down here is, so you had this drug problem. You overcame the drug problem. Then you become a really young CEO in a position that you admittedly say, I'm not really sure that I know what I'm doing. And so you are trying to succeed in an area where you had some tough beginnings. So let's talk about the drug problem again for a second in terms of how did you bounce back from that? You know, I don't want to equate that to like, you know, a pandemic, but you also had an issue with during the pandemic that you had to deal with that is beyond just the pandemic itself. You had another situation where your business got attacked. And I think we can touch on that. So I want to get some sense from you on how do you bounce back when really bad stuff happens, whether it's a drug problem, whether it's a pandemic, how do you bounce back in that environment?
I think the biggest thing is you have to want to. So, you know, I get asked the question sometimes, you know, did you have to go into rehab from the drug problem? And I said, no, and people are surprised, but rehab only works when you want to make a change in your life. And I wanted to. I knew that that was not the path that I wanted to live. And part of it was my own personal drive, and part of it was how I was being perceived. And I didn't understand that about myself a lot back then. I've done a lot of work with coaching and really digging deep into understanding myself better. So I understand why I make the decisions that I make, but I didn't know that then. But I knew that I wanted something different. And that is a big motivator. And I think it's been the foundation for being able to bounce back in a lot of other situations. The other thing that I never lost belief in myself. And I believe that's because I had people who believed in me around me. I would not have been able to do this without my mom. I would not have been able to do this without my dear friend, Joe Phillips, who gave me $2,500 to get back to Colorado so I could get on my feet, and several other people. They were my cheerleaders. And so every time that I struggled, I knew I had these people, my network, who were going to help me stay believing in myself. And so I know not everybody has that. I know that a lot of these things come from self-confidence issues, and that was not my particular one. I understand that now. But if you don't believe in yourself, then you have to surround yourself with people who do believe in you, even if it's just one person, because that can help you keep going when you just want to sit there and beat yourself up for making another stupid decision and screwing up your life again. When you have someone like, yeah, you did, but you know, you can do this and I'm going to be your accountability buddy and really help you through this. And so in those early days, those were two, you know, of the really things that kept me motivated is I wanted to make a change. I knew I didn't want to be a drug abuser. I knew I wanted to be a leader. And what am I going to do that? And then having that support system to help me.
Okay. Now, did you know that you were going to succeed? Did you know what the ultimate outcome was going to be? How did you think about that?
No, I never imagined, you know, especially laying on the floor of my apartment in 2006, that I would be where I am today. And I think that's the conundrum of trying to set your life on the course you want it to go, right? You can say, here's my vision, here's my plan, this is what I want. And that's really important. You need to have that. But the chance of you ending up like that is really slim. And life is going to take all different kinds of, you know, twists and turns. And so I always was a leader, but I didn't know that I wanted to be a leader who ran a company, right? I moved to Durango to save my life and to clean myself up. And so then I was given that opportunity. And then it was like, okay, now what do I do with this? And then this is the next opportunity. Okay, what am I going to do with this? And where I am today, never, ever would have imagined that it's where I would have ended up, you know, even 5 years ago. You know, I certainly was a lot clearer then on what I wanted, but still life has taken all kinds of twists and turns and I'm in an entirely different place, like my home office. Which has been amazing and going to change my life in a whole different way. And I never would have guessed. So yeah, I don't think you can say that's where I'm going to go and have, you know, a realistic expectation that that's actually where you're going to be. But you still have to have that North Star to help you take action.
So let's go back to 2009, 2010. You're a young, new CEO at this company that has been run by the two founders for more than two decades. Did you get any pushback from the staff there? And was it difficult for you as a young person, maybe as a woman? What were some of those early difficulties that you faced?
Yeah, I had a couple of people tell me that they weren't going to work for me, that they worked for the two founders. I think one of the earliest struggles that I had was with our sales manager at the time, and he was the face of Stone Age. Our customers loved him. He had been with the company for 20 plus years, and he was completely insubordinate and disrespectful to me. He would come into my office. We would agree on a plan. We would talk about the issues. He would make a commitment, and then he would walk out of my office and do the exact opposite of what we had agreed upon. And he trashed me behind my back. And, you know, I was insecure about it because I didn't really, you know what I was doing. And I was young, and he had 20 plus years of experience. And if I fired him, would our customers leave? And would my employees be mad at me? And so I tried and I tried and I tried until finally, after probably a good year of trying, I realized that there was nothing I was going to be able to do. He was not going to accept me as the leader of the company. And so I decided that I was going to have to fire him. And I lost so much sleep. All of those questions of, you know, telling yourself horrible stories about all the awful things that are going to happen when you do this. But I had no choice. It was not going to work. I could not run the company that way. So I had to fire him. And it was really interesting. Like, he looked at me and it was for the first time he had respect in his eyes. Cause he's like, yeah, you're right. I shouldn't be working here anymore. And then none of the bad things that I thought were going to happen happened. In fact, my sales team stepped up and blossomed, and our customers called and were like, oh, this person is doing such a great job. And I don't even notice that old sales manager is gone. And it was a really important lesson for me to learn that, one, it's okay to try to turn relationships around. I needed to own my part, right? I wasn't experienced and I did have a lot to learn. But you also have to establish boundaries and establish yourself as a leader. And that was one of the times where, I mean, I really thought I was going to have to leave the company because I thought it was going to be him or me. And when the founders were like, no way, it's you, and we support you in firing him, and then seeing the results, it gave me a ton of confidence to just trust myself and to know that I had done enough and it was okay to let him go.
Well, I think there's an important point in here about firing people. And I know this is something that the coaches here at CEO Coaching International talk about, and they'll ask a question sometimes to one of their clients, which is, when was the last time you fired somebody too soon? And so now that you've had a number of years to reflect back on this, you said you gave this guy about a year. As you reflect back and you've got more experience now, how do you think about that situation? When would you have fired him, knowing what you know now? Would it have taken a year? Would you have done it sooner? How do you think about firing someone who's not working out?
No, it definitely would have not taken me a year. And I've had other lessons like this too, right? Firing people is the worst thing I think that you can do. Like especially for me, I care about people so deeply, even if they're not a good fit and even if they don't like me. And so I've learned this lesson multiple times, I would say, but now I really have so much less tolerance for it. And so, no, I would have still tried because I think that that's important. I have success stories of employees doing unbelievable turnarounds because you have candid conversations, you support them. I've gotten a lot of my employees coaches and have seen tremendous results from it. But when somebody is actively undermining you, breaking policy, lying, those are the three things that I don't tolerate. And so, you know, I would have given it a couple of months maybe now, if even that at this point, because I think that really speaks to somebody's character and you can't have people with poor character on your team and build a successful company.
Let's move forward to 2020 and we're at the beginnings of the pandemic, which of course is changing everybody's business and everybody's lives. But you had something happen to your company at the beginning of the pandemic. What was that?
Well, Steve, because I like you so much, I'm going to talk about 2020, but I made this rule that the first rule of 2021 is that no one talks about 2020. That's how bad it was.
That's how bad it was. Yes. But we need to learn some lessons here too. I think there was an important one here about how you handled, you know, we've talked a lot about the pandemic, so we don't have to specifically talk about that, but there was something else that happened during the COVID period that made it even more challenging for you. And I want to go into that here for just a minute.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I was totally just teasing. So on February 21st of 2020, I got a call from my IT manager saying all of our IT systems are down. I'm not 100% sure what's going on. I'm hoping it's just an issue with service, but it could be a hack. So I drove into the office and sure enough, after about 5 hours of exploring and trying to get into our systems all different ways, we figured out that it was actually an encryption attack, ransomware, had a ransom note on one of our server systems and everything was frozen. Everything was frozen.
What's going through your mind at this point?
How did this happen to me? I mean, we're a tiny little company in Durango, Colorado. Like, how would we be on anybody's radar, right? And then realizing that I made a huge mistake, that I was not taking cybersecurity seriously enough because I just assumed that we're a small company in a rural area. Well, that's not how it works, right? They don't know who you are or where you are, right? And so, yeah, then I started to really freak out because what do you do? And how much is this ransom note, are the ransom going to be? Millions of dollars. So I panicked and then I called my attorney and my attorney says, don't worry, Carrie, we have a 24-hour cybersecurity concierge service. And I'm like, concierge service? I'm not on vacation. This is like the most stressful thing that's ever happened to me. And, you know, it was like totally inappropriate way to call it. But they assembled a team that was made up of a negotiation expert, a forensics team, and an IT team that would be there to support us as we had to rebuild all of our systems and to figure out what was going on. So we kind of took a three-pronged attack with it. And it was start negotiating with the hackers. Let's start going in and seeing where the issues are. Can we rebuild anything? Do we have to pay the ransomware? And then how are we going to make sure things are protected so that we can do the forensics to find out exactly what happened? So that night I went home and I called 25 of my employees who had been with the company or had been in key positions. I said, Sunday morning, 7 a.m., everybody's at the office and we are going to figure out how to ship product and our customers are not going to feel a thing. It's our busiest time of year and no one's going to feel this. And my team pulled off a miracle. We had our biggest shipping week of our history, first week of March of 2020. We shipped everything manually. And in the entire 4 weeks we were down, we missed four orders. It shipped millions and millions of dollars worth of products, 100,000 line items. I mean, it makes me emotional because that team pulled together like nothing I've ever seen. And we were determined to not let the hackers win. We did not have to pay the ransom, which was only $350,000. So, I mean, we could have done it if we had to. It wasn't going to break us. And that's how they work. These particular hackers, they come in, do just the encryption. They don't steal data and they make it painful, but not so painful that you don't pay it. But luckily we were in a situation that we didn't have to. And in 4 weeks, we were back up and running. And then I promptly told everybody to not come to work because of COVID.
Yeah. Okay. So two things I want to ask here on that. One is, you said that your team had like a record shipping week there in March. So there had to have been some things that led up to that in terms of the culture of the organization, your leadership that you had in place, so that when you called them and said, you're going to be here at 7 a.m. on Sunday morning and we're going to do this, that they said, absolutely, I'm going to be there. So what were the things you did in the months, the years leading up to that, that generated that kind of loyalty? And then second, what did you do in the moment from that Sunday morning to the next couple of weeks that rallied the troops in the heat of the moment there?
Yeah. So Stone Age is an employee-owned company. It was employee-owned before I joined. I led the transition to a formal ESOP, which is a different structure than what we had before. And the creation of what we call the own it mindset, which is really, you know, it was at that time when we created it, 35 years of a certain way that you showed up, you know, behaviors and traits that you needed to be successful at Stone Age. And we really got it dialed in about 5 years ago. And our employees embody the own it mindset. And there's a couple of components. It's be a great teammate, right? How do I show up for my team every day? Am I humble? Am I motivated? Am I building relationships? Am I thinking about the greater good versus myself? Am I a self-leader, right? Do I take accountability for my attitude, my actions, my mindset, my mistakes? And am I resilient? And do I keep it real? How do I show up as a self-leader? Then what we call deliver on the Stone Age Assurance Promise, which is our promise to our customers to do whatever it takes to cause them to say, why would I choose anybody but Stone Age? And so it was really the accumulation of all of this work around, you know, how we perform well as employees, how we treat each other, how we look at our customers, that when I made that those calls on that Saturday night, people were like, absolutely, I will be there for you. And it's because we have this ownership culture. We share in the success of the company. We are transparent. I have gotten up in front of my team and cried before. You know, we are just like, hey, we're people, we're keeping it real and we are in this together and we're going to share in the success. And hey, when stuff's hard, we all have to, you know, tighten our belts or roll up our sleeves too. So it's really been built on this whole idea that we think and act like owners and that's how we show up.
Yeah. And it just goes to show just how important leadership is. And that had you not put those things in place, had you not had that kind of culture leading up to it, you probably would have had a different result and you wouldn't have had the team rallying around like that.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. And that's that Monday morning when I came into the office and I had told everybody, you know, we've got an issue that's going on. You know, we're going to have a company meeting at 8 a.m. Everybody was there and the room was silent and people were really scared about what it meant. And I stood in front of them and I told them everything that I knew and I told them everything that I didn't know. And I committed to them to keep them informed every step of the way. And we all are determined to not pay those hackers a penny. And the whole team stood up and cheered because that's what they wanted to know is like, how much was it and are we paying it? Right. And so that is what kept everybody motivated in those early days of figuring out how to do all of this work manually. And then people who were not typically working together in different departments were side by side, right? It was like all hands on deck. If you don't have an ERP system to get into, guess what? We're in the warehouse. You're helping pack and pull products and making sure we're keeping track of everything. So people who normally didn't get to work together worked side by side. And so the relationships that were built, it was truly incredible. We had, you know, foxholes set up where we had this whole process of like an assembly line of how we were keeping track of things so that when we were back online, that we didn't have a huge accounting mess. And so that is what kept everybody motivated going forward, was this whole rally of the entire team and the relationships that they built with their colleagues who they normally wouldn't have had that relationship with. And it was profound. It was like nothing that I've ever experienced or been part of.
So now that you've got some distance between that ransomware attack and it had a happy ending, looking back on it, is there anything that you would reflect on and say, knowing what I know now, I wish I would have done more of this, or I would have done less of this, or I would have started this, or I would have stopped this? Anything along those lines from that particular incident?
Not from how we handled it. I feel like we handled it exceptionally well. But before that, I would, and I always will, take it so much more seriously. I am like many, 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 many other readers out there who think it's never going to happen to them. And I just didn't want to spend the money, to be honest, to put it into place. And it's so much more expensive to go through a cyber attack than it is to just do it right the first time. And so I think that my ignorance and, you know, not wanting to spend the money on it, you know, it was easy for me to put the blinders on. And if there's anything that I would have changed, it would have been to take it more seriously. That being said, it was such an unbelievable learning lesson and such a culture booster that I don't really even regret it. Like, we learned things about ourselves and we showed, especially new employees who hadn't necessarily had a long experience with that employee ownership mindset, what it was like to pull together as a team and to win like we won. And so, you know, I mean, probably people would kill me for saying this, but like, I'm kind of glad it happened. It was a profound lesson and so much good came out of it that I don't have any regrets.
Excellent. All right. Well, Carrie, I could keep talking to you for hours here, but I'm afraid we're going to have to get ready to wrap it up here. So finish with just a couple of things. So one is, I always like to ask if there's anything else that you want to add here or share that we haven't talked about yet.
I think the only thing that I would say, you know, all of this is really about resiliency, and anybody can bounce back from anything. Some of it's easier than others, and it doesn't mean that it doesn't take a lot of work and that you won't question yourself. But if there's anything I could leave anybody with, is that you can get through hard things. And so just believe in yourself and take that action, even if it's a tiny little step that nobody else sees, that will set things in motion that you probably won't expect. So don't be afraid to dig deep and to figure out how to get through the hard stuff. That's what humans are meant to do.
Definitely. Now, I do want to ask you a couple rapid fire questions, but before I do that, I want you to share how people can get in touch with you. I know you've got a couple of podcasts and you have a blog. So what are some ways that if people want to continue to learn and hear more from you, how can they get to that?
Sure. So you can find everything about me on my website, which is kerrysiggins.com, KerrySiggins.com. I have two podcasts. I have a leadership podcast called Reflect Forward, which is on all the major podcast platforms. I also have a very industrial cleaning specific podcast called Industrial Theory. So unless you want to know all about the world of cleaning, it might not be for you, but it still has really cool people on it. And then LinkedIn is the best way to find me through social media, and it's at Carrie Siggins.
Excellent. All right. So are you ready to go on the hot seat?
Let's do it.
As if you weren't already on the hot seat here. All right. Here's just a few questions. So what is a new skill that you are trying to develop?
So I'm a writer and I write a ton of blogs and articles, and I'm starting to put it into a book. And I have realized that writing a book is so different than writing blogs and writing articles. And I have had to learn an entirely new way of thinking about writing and structuring my writing. I've been learning all about Zettelkasten and how I can do research for my book. And so it's really challenging and fun. It's a little uncomfortable because I like to write. I write all the time. And now I'm like, oh, this is it. I'm a new writer again. So it's a lot of fun. It's really challenging to start to write a book.
Do you have a tentative date on when the book's going to be published?
No, I'm still just in the beginning stages of it. I probably have 30,000 words or written so, and they say that you need to write twice what you're going to publish. So I've got a lot more to go, but I hope to have the entire book done by the end of this year, and then we'll start to work on what comes next.
Great. Well, we'll have to have you back on the podcast when the book comes out.
Yeah. Yes.
All right. How about a strange daily habit? Do you have one of those?
Well, I don't think it's strange, but my husband certainly does.
But will our audience think it's strange? That's the key thing.
Some people, maybe some, but some might go, that's me too. So I get up at 4 o'clock every morning to work out for 2 hours. I have a ton of energy and I have to move my body. That's like my stress relief and all those things about like rest days and whatnot. Like that is not how I work. And so I get up and I work out for an hour and a half, 2 hours every morning. And that's how I start my day. So it's an early one, but it's the best way, in my opinion, to start.
What kind of workout do you do?
So I ride my FRL, but thank God for my Peloton. I love my Peloton, especially through the pandemic. So I ride my Peloton. I do some sort of like a HIIT weight-ish workout, and then I do some yoga. And I mix it up a little bit. Sometimes I do bar, like I've been teaching myself ballet, which is really quite funny. My son tells me you are not meant to do ballet, Mom, but I like to just do different things. So sometimes it's an intense workout, sometimes it's not. And that's how I start my day.
Great. Yeah. All right. So one final thing here, I'm going to start a sentence and I'd like you to finish it. So the sentence is, what I know to be true is?
That being a mom has made me a 1,000 times better leader. All those that times back in Austin, I actually didn't want to be a mom. And when I was 23, I tried to get my OBGYN to tie my tubes. And she was like, no, that's dumb. Don't do that. And I was like, I should not have kids. You know, of course I was a complete mess. And then I have my son, Jack. And oh my God, he has changed my life and he has made me such a much better leader. And I am so unbelievably grateful to have a cool son who holds me accountable and teaches me all kinds of lessons every day.
Well, Carrie, I think that's a great place to wrap up here. And I appreciate you being so open and transparent here. You have an incredible story, an incredible journey from the issues with the drug problems to turning it around to being the CEO of a very fast growing company. So I appreciate you sharing that great story with us.
Well, thanks for asking about it. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Now, I have a question for you. How are you going to implement and benefit from the ideas that you hear on our show? Well, we would love to have a conversation with you about that. So please visit us at ceocoachinginternational.com. We can then set up a call and we can talk about how we can help you make big happen in your business. Thanks, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you.